Can a wine really smell like minerality? Or can we taste the soil the vines are grown on? And also, of course, why do wines smell different as they age? Hi, everybody. I'm your host, Emily Steckenborn, and you're listening to Bottled in China. This is the podcast that dives into the delicious and fascinating world of food and beverage. We cover innovation, market trends, and culture with thought leaders from around the world. Today, we speak with Nicolas Qui, Master of Wine. He's no stranger to the world of wine. Born into a family working in the wine industry, he's a Master of Wine, 2 Master Degrees in Enology, and an MBA, and over 25 years of experience. Nicolas currently serves as the Chief Winemaking and Operations Officer at Crimson Wine Group, where he's responsible for the operation of 6 estate wineries and associate vineyards across California, Oregon, and Washington. He offers lectures and seminars on a regular basis, including a recent online masterclass on history and terroir that define the wines of Beaujolais. Nicolas currently is based in Portland, Oregon. And let me tell you, he is one of the most fascinating people I've spoken to, and he really knows his subject when it comes to the word terroir. So before we dive into this podcast, don't forget to follow us on Instagram where you can connect with me directly. And if you love this podcast, share with a friend or click 5 stars on iTunes to show your support. Cheers. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Bottled in China. Today, I'm very excited to speak with Nicolas. Nicolas, welcome to the episode.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now, I'm really excited because today we're going to be talking a bit about wine. Of course, this is your passion for life. You're a master of wine. You've been working in the industry with over 25 years of experience. You have 2 master degrees in enology, even an MBA. So, I mean, I think we're going to be able to do so many podcasts with you, but today I'm excited, of course, to dive into more of the basic questions we might have when it comes to minerality and aromas and wine development. So right now, I want to talk to you a little bit with your background. What do you find is the most exciting thing about the wine industry right now?
I think the most exciting part of the industry right now is the tremendous challenge of climate change and how it's putting what we thought was an established order. You grow Pinot Noir in Burgundy, and you grow Sauvignon Blanc in the Loire Valley, just to use a couple of French example, completely upside down, and how new regions are opening, old regions have to evolve. I think it's a challenge, but also a time of opportunity for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now, actually, you're also in charge of Crimson Wine Group. Can you tell us a little bit? It's been a very tough vintage out in the U.S. What's your outlook? And do you feel that some of the grapes can be saved, or how is that looking out for everybody?
It was a challenging vintage, not only because we had to deal with the pandemic and how to manage our harvest, but also because of the wildfires up and down the coast. I'd say in general, if you step back and you take a 30,000 feet view, it hasn't impacted a whole lot of California. California is a big state. It's a big region. And so if you look at it as a totality, probably 95% of California is fine. There are a few areas in California that have been impacted by the fire to various degrees. So it's a little early to decide what for those regions. And so, you know, the North Coast in general were the most impacted. But when I say North Coast, that's Napa Valley, Sonoma Valley. But there are a few things that have changed since the last fire. I think a lot of people have learned how to deal with a fire, when to pick, what to do with the grapes. And there's a few techniques now to mitigate a little bit the taint. So I don't think it'll be as dramatic on the totality of the vintage as most people think. I'm quite hopeful, actually.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit about the 2020 vintage in Australia and how there was so much news about Australia burning down and wine and smoke taint. And yet the 2020 vintage, for the most part, was actually a really fantastic one. So, you know, I think there's a lot of fear, but then looking back, hopefully, like you said, it could be controlled, and now with more experience and expertise, we can really be able to control in a better way. So yes. I want to dive in about a term. You actually were writing a post on LinkedIn, and that's kind of what sparked it for me. Something that a lot of people use in wine, I think, I don't know if you're for it or against it, but it's the term minerality. And that term for me is something that automatically a lot of people would assume with old world. But can you tell us your view on minerality? Because it's not necessarily understood. And then also, if you use it yourself in your own wine notes.
Yeah, I don't mind the term. First, I don't think it's my place to decide what's correct and not correct. And people use whatever vernacular they'd like to use. But I do think sometimes it's a little misleading, because without understanding what we mean by it, then we tend to think that maybe there are minerals in the wine that we can smell or taste. And that's quite unlikely. But, you know, it's no different to me than saying I can smell banana. We all understand there are no bananas in the wine, that it reminds us of the smell of banana. So that's the basic, I think, of my, you know, I don't have a quarrel with the word minerality, but I think it's important for folks to understand that there are no or very little minerals in wine, that the only mineral that we can find is in quantities is a potassium. And like other minerals, potassium does not taste or smell like anything. So the idea that a wine may taste mineral because of the mineral content is not accurate. Again, that doesn't mean that it's not because it's grown in some certain soils that the wine may have some characteristic that reminds you of minerality. That seems a little far-fetched to me, because there are many, it's difficult to taste different soils into the wine. I don't think people, you know, we talk about it very often in a romantic way, but I don't think people can really identify granite or schist or different types of soils or different types of bedrock, mm-hmm. let alone that many times the roots of the vine don't even reach that bedrock. But that's a different problem. So I think there is, you can use a term, but don't try to link it to the soil. Don't try to link it to the bedrock. There are factors that we know are linked to the feeling of minerality. And those are things such as high level of acidity in the wine, the presence of phenolics in the wines, especially in, you know, we're talking about white wine, which is interesting. Very often with minerality, we talk about white wine. We less often talk about red wine with minerality. So the presence of phenolic in white wine that gives a little saltiness to the wine could be associated to minerality. Certain smells perhaps that remind us of the mineral world could be associated to minerality. We know, for example, that wines aged on lees can be a little chalky. Wines that have been, or grapes that have been exposed to the sun may develop a character like petrol that is kind of minerally. So there are different ways that we can have a feeling of minerality, but I think it's important to realize that they're probably not linked whatsoever to the soil the grapes have been grown on.
Right. Well, actually, you know, for myself, whenever I smell a German Riesling, like you mentioned, a lot of the time, and I believe, especially when I started my wine career, everybody was saying that petrol aroma comes from the soil. And now we realize today that it actually doesn't come from the soil. And like you said, it's more the sun that's actually producing this on the grapes, which I find is a little bit interesting. But I think still a lot of people refer that very characteristic petrol character back to Germany, right? So it's interesting that the more we do in terms of research, the more we realize it's so many factors that affect the taste of the wine, not just the soil that was once purely believed.
Yes. I mean, that compound, that petrol compound is called tetradihydronaphthalene, or TDN for short. And it comes from the degradation of a pigment in the skin of the grapes that is an orange pigment that is called carotene, the same one you find in your carrots. And that pigment over time degrades into that compound that smells like petrol. So and to get that compound on the grapes, you need poor soils that will create low vigor in the vines, and so there will be less leaves. So the grapes will be more exposed to the sun and low yields. And so both of those are commonly found in the Moselle or in Alsace, especially on sloped vineyards that are very poor in nutrients and have a small vines, which we all associate with quality sometimes. But yes, there is nobody has poured petrol in there, or the roots are not reaching into petroleum and bringing it into the grapes.
Right. What about, you know, Sancerre? Because sometimes you get a lot of people that get that gunflint aroma, especially in the soils of Silex. Is there something to do with that? Or do you think, like you said, it could be some lees work? Or what would maybe be hiding behind that?
So lots of suspicions. But I think gunflint is quite linked to reductive winemaking. So winemaking in the absence of oxygen, that is linked to aging on lees. And it's quite used in Chardonnay, and especially the modern Chardonnays you taste those days have a lot of that lees aging to the point of reduction. And there's actually a compound that we know that is called benzyl mercaptan that is associated with the smell of gunflint. So I think, again, that's nothing to do with the soil. It's probably more of a winemaking technique than it is coming from where the grapes are grown.
Right. Absolutely fascinating, because I think a lot of people who are listening who have been told or read, you know, and I think, like you said, it's a little bit of the wine's charm, right? When you go and attend a wine tasting and they mention Rutherford dust and they mention the chalky soils. And then, you know, as we hear this, we realize perhaps it's not so much the soil talking than it is the winemaker talking again, right?
Yes. Now, and this, I'm not saying the soil doesn't matter. The structure of the soil probably matters greatly as far as how the water drains through the soils, water retention, and probably the amount of nutrients. So how does it translate to the vigor of the vine, how many leaves versus fruit it's making and so on. But exactly what the soil is made of, what's the bedrock below it, has been probably overstated over the years. Yes.
Right. Well, something else that has been a little bit overstated is also aging wine. And, you know, before we dive into the science, people always think that the longer you age wine, the better it becomes. So I want to talk a bit about tertiary aromas and the evolution of a wine. What's your take? The consumer perception that wine really gets better with age. What's your feeling about that?
So when we're talking about tertiary aromatics, we're talking about aromatics that develop either during aging at the winery or in the bottle. And they are sometimes part of the complexity of a wine. But there are many wines that do not rely on tertiary aromatics for their quality. And actually, it would be distracting from their quality. Let's take a lot of whites, but some reds too. Let's take a few, for example. A Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand relies on a very intense, pungent aromatics, and aged aromatics of honey or forest floor would be distracting and not welcome. Same for a Moscato d'Asti, for example, that relies on a explosive blossom, orange blossom aromatics. Having aged character on that wine would distract it from its primary reason for being. So some Beaujolais wine, if it's a Beaujolais Nouveau, for example, and that is very estery and intensely aromatic, that's also not made to have tertiary aromatics. So most of the wines that we actually make in the world are probably not made to have tertiary aromatics. They're made to be drunk young. They're made to be enjoyed when the fruit character, the primary fruit, is high, and when the secondary aromatics from fermentations are also high. So I would agree with you that the vast majority of wine is not made to age, and actually their quality is reduced when they're starting to get tertiary aromatics. I think some of the reason why there's such a legend about aging wine is because it is true that for some of the greatest wine in the world, at least as far as dollar value, maybe not as far as what you like every day to drink, but as far as what they sold for, those wines gain quality by having tertiary aromatics. And so by association, I think we make we we if it's good for a high-end Bordeaux, it's got to be good for all wine. That's unfortunately not true.
Right. And I think actually you've mentioned something that's really important. It's not for every wine. And, you know, being in China, I think that the perception, especially 5, 10 years ago, now it's slightly different, but there was always that perception that you need to keep wine for a long time. Although people were not doing that. People were actually were not aging their wines at all. But the idea was that a wine should be able to age. And they thought it was for every single wine. And as you mentioned, it really is not. And especially wines that are more fruity definitely don't deserve that. You also mentioned a little bit that perhaps it's the style of the wine, the structure of the wine, right? Acidity, tannins, concentration. Now, for a novice consumer, this probably sounds like quite a lot. But what are some styles that you say you need to age and what or should age, have the capability of aging? And what styles would you suggest to the listeners definitely do not age?
So besides the aromatics that we've talked about, the other compounds that change during aging are structural elements that you've mentioned. Acidity, sometimes sweetness, if the wine is sweet, tannins, those phenolics in the wine for sure age as well. And so in general, for wine to age, we want lots of stuff in there because the wine has to hold the distance. So wines that tend to have lots of sugar, lots of tannins, lots of acid, all those wines are probably good candidates for aging. Sometimes they can be also so intense or so concentrated with those elements in their youth that they're actually not very pleasant. And so they're built almost to be enjoyed many years later. So yeah, that's what I would look for those type of wines. So if you look in the world of wine, what would that be? Well, it's true that wines made from Cabernet Sauvignon, especially Bordeaux, tend to have high acidity and high level of tannins. And so they are predisposed to age. They have enough of those compounds that will dissipate over time, that they can age for decades. Wines that have a lot of sugar, like I'm not going to go to a port quite yet because I didn't talk about alcohol. That's important too for aging. But let's take a Tokaj, for example, that would have a Tokaj Aizu, so with those botrytized berries, would have such a high level of sugar that it will be preserved for many years. And then I want to go back to alcohol because I didn't mention that earlier. But wines that have a high level of alcohol are also quite preserved. And so that's why some of the wines that age the longest are fortified wines. And right, fortified wines that have sugar, those can be almost indestructible and can be aged for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, on a personal level, I collect a lot of port, especially vintage port, because first of all, I find it to be absolutely incredible value. And as you mentioned, you can age that for decades, if not even longer than that. And I just find them to be such a treat to open up something that comes from 50, 60 years ago. And it still has so much beautiful aromatics like coffee. And it's just interesting to drink. And it's a story, a bottled story, basically. But seems that not a lot of people are catching on to the port trend, I believe. Not just yet.
Don't tell anyone. I agree. They're great values. And there is nothing more pleasurable to remember a special anniversary and have an old bottle of port somewhere. And they will last a lifetime.
Right. We'll keep that a secret.
For a childbirth, if you want to put a case of wine down, vintage port, if fortunately it's a declared vintage year, it's quite awesome. And you can have it forever. And maybe you can give 6 bottles of that port to your child when he's 50.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really awesome, interesting. Yeah. Especially for the price, right? You can't get better than that. Then the other thing also I just wanted to kind of highlight, the other week I had a Sémillon from Hunter Valley, which surprised everybody. You know, that's a great example too of a white wine that can truly age. Can you tell us what are some white wines that can age? Or what examples would you give for that?
Quite a few. So we've talked about sweet wines. Many of them are white. And so most, I hate to say all because there's always one that I'm not thinking about, but the vast majority of the greatest sweet white wine on the planet are made to age. Would that be a Sauternes? We mentioned Tokaj, a lot of the Trockenbären Schlese from Germany. All those can age for a very long time, 20, 30, 40 years. many champagne that have high acidity, vintage champagne, are good agers. Just as their brother in Burgundy made a Chardonnay, they're also great agers just for their high acidity. I do like the idea of wines like a Hunter Valley Semillon to age. And there's another little thing that a little secret that is not good to share too broadly is to age Muscadets, for example. And Muscadets are the same situation and than Hunter Valley Semillon. They are very high acid, modest alcohol wines. And because they have such a high acidity, they can age 10, 20, 25 years, no problem, from a good producer. And they are really inexpensive. So
Really?
you can buy a good Muscadet. I don't know what the prices are where you are, but where I am, we can probably buy a top Muscadet for $15 to $20. And you can put it down for 10 years. And because of the high acidity, it will develop very slowly and harmoniously. And you're going to have a lot of beautiful tertiary aromatics, just like you would have on a Hunter Valley Semillon develop.
So I've never tried that, and I think from a lot of what I've read, nobody really highlights Muscadet as being able to age, at least from what I've read. Can you tell us what you would expect to get? I know you said a bit like Hunter, but for everybody listening, kind of what are some aromatics or how does the palate transform, I guess, with age on a Muscadet?
Yeah, it would have some classic white wine age character. You might have a little bit of honey character, sometime a little malty. You could have a little bit a caramel character that comes in on the top of it. So those kind of aromatics. And obviously the intensity of those aromatics increases as the wine ages. So it starts small, subtle, and then it gets to go far. Not all Muscadet are made to age. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of entry-level Muscadet that are just quaffable, good with oysters, done. But there are a fair amount of very good producers that will age a Muscadet on the lees for quite some time, much more than the traditional level, and then would sell their wine in that $15 to $20 range usually. And those are quite worth seeking and storing.
This is absolutely the best wine tip I've heard in a long time. So don't worry, Nicola, I'm going to follow your recommendation because I'm all about aging wines, and especially aging white wine is my favorite thing. And like you said, I think people on the episode really know that I'm a big German Riesling fan, and whenever I go to Germany, I collect so many bottles, and I actually mostly drink them all. That's the only problem. But I have to start keeping them more, which is the most difficult job to do.
And Muscadet is so inexpensive that you can afford to buy a case every year, and it will cost you maybe a maximum of $200 for the case. And you put 12 bottle down. And if you do that every year, 10 years from now, you have a stock and you can start depleting and have fun with
I'm looking forward for the depletion.
it.
So I want to talk a little bit about groups in terms of specific families, in terms of aging aromatics. A lot of the questions I get, I'm sure you get them all the time as well, especially when you're presenting wines with age. A young Burgundy might have strawberry. And then as it ages, it gets more tobacco. I call it tossed wet earth. Why are the molecules changing, or what's happening? How is this all coming out? And can you explain to us a little bit more? Can you clarify the myth of how wine ages and these characters transform?
Yeah, so the molecule don't really change. They're all in the bottle. What happens is that they recombined into different molecule. And it's a pretty complicated part of wine. First, because they're very small and there are not many of them. It's just amazing how potent they are. And the combinations are infinite. So it's I'm trying to find an analogy, but it's really a puzzle you can make many times with the same pieces. So we're talking about maybe 3,000 compounds that can dissociate and recombine into other components. So that's what happens. So for example, if you have an aldehyde of some sort, or that aldehyde may smell fruity when it's young, and then it would break down into a different aldehyde as it ages, and then smell like fig or leather as it ages.
Right. So it's more in terms of the family. Interesting. You know, it just always gets me because whenever people ask that question, I think there's just so many components in a bottle that change. It's not only the aromas. Like you said, it's the texture, it's the tannin, everything starts to change. And it's a completely different wine than in its youth.
Yeah, and it will change, if I can add one thing. It will change differently based on several parameters such as the closure, how much oxygen get into the wine, the temperature in which the wine has been stored. Hotter temperature tend to age the wine faster than colder temperature. So it's extremely hard to taste the wine at a certain period and forecast how it's going to taste 20 years from now.
Right. Actually, it's funny you say that, because now with the new technology, supposedly that screw caps are able to also allow some oxygen penetration into the wine. Do you believe that's something you would look into and you would be open to having a great wine under screw cap, but choosing a cap that's specific to allowing the wine to age? Do you believe in that, or are you still very much believing in cork?
Well, no, I like screw caps, actually. I think it's probably better than cork for long-term aging. Most of those reactions do not need oxygen, actually. So right. They happen in the absence of oxygen. So there's probably no reason, the legend of saying I need the cork for the wine to breathe, it's probably not necessary. It would definitely, I think, be not necessary for super high-end wines. Because if you want to age a wine for 20 years or 30 years or more, I actually think cork is not excellent. The only reason cork is good is probably because it can accommodate pressure changes in a container versus some of the closure that don't answer well to pressure changes that may be due to temperature. The wine gets really cold, it gets really hot. The cork can move up and down in the neck of the bottle. But that's not the case for anything else than as a liner, like a screw cap, for example, or vino lock or things like this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow. I feel like today we're really breaking all the myths down and really being able to discuss all the questions I think I've had, and I think a lot of consumers have had also in their journey and enjoying fine wines. But Nicola, of course, my last question is, how can we get in touch with you? How can we learn more about wine? And how can we follow those awesome LinkedIn posts that you've been putting out recently with so much valuable information?
So I am not very public, and I don't have a website or anything like this. The only thing I use is LinkedIn. So it's really easy. You just go on LinkedIn, find my name, and then you just ask to be whatever it is in LinkedIn, a friend or whatever that is, and I will add you to the party, to the club.
Right. And just for anybody listening, I just wanted to highlight that on LinkedIn, sometimes you share your tasting notes. You also share some information more on the science of wine. And if you're a little bit of a wine nerd or interested in that, I think Nicola has so much to share on his LinkedIn. So make sure to connect and also to learn more about wine in a really fascinating way. Thanks so much, Nicola, for being a guest on this podcast.
It was really fun. Thank you.
Cheers.